The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 7.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
All right, boys and girls, today we're going to have some high-level learning for you. This is something, just so you know how I plan this thing out, I had intended originally to sort of lead up to this, like to give you some more red meat economics things, and I was going to talk about the Fed and excess reserves and all that stuff. But I thought, no, this is something that I'm really excited that I want to walk you guys through. This is a fascinating result, and I don't think a lot of people do a good job explaining it. So what I'm going to try to do here, what the topic is to end the suspense, is we're going to go over what are called the first and second incompleteness theorems of the mathematical logician Kurt Gödel. Now, some of you are like, okay, Bob, life is short. What are you talking about? This is one of those results where it is cited in all sorts of different fields, right? So I remember as an undergrad taking a philosophy of mind class. So these results came up all the time. Any kind of discussion of artificial intelligence and, you know, what can computers do? It also spills over into economics, especially in the tradition of the Austrian school and with praxeology, that some wise guy might say, oh, hey, well, you guys think that you're going to rest economics on a bunch of axiomatic foundations. Well, Kurt Gödel showed the futility of that approach. Okay. So this is something that people use. It comes up a lot in computer science as well. Alan Turing had some results on what might be called undecidable statements, things like that. If you've heard of the halting problem in computer programming, this is often discussed in the same conversation. So this is a huge result that is cited all over the place by a lot of people who don't really know what they're talking about when it comes to this. And here, let me be a little more humble myself, I have not literally proven Gödel's theorem. In contrast, Arrow's impossibility theorem, so that's something from social choice theory that you study, it falls under the umbrella of modern economics, mathematical economics. There, I really do walk through the proof. If you go to Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom, and remember, if you're going to do that, use my link. So that's bobmurphyshow.com/classroom. And then if you go ahead and get that, you'll see if you take my course, it's the second History of Economic Thought course, we go through and I do like the intuitive big picture. Hey, this is what this guy Kenneth Arrow did with his famous impossibility theorem. But then one of the lectures that, you know, is sort of optional if people want to go through it or if they want to skip it and move on. But I literally go through a proof of Arrow's theorem. Okay, here, that's not what I'm going to do for you guys right now because for one thing, I haven't done the proof, but also that's not what my goal is here. So what my goal is here is to give enough of the flavor of the proof so I think you'll have a much better grasp on what he actually did. And then that will help you, I think, evaluate when other people come along and, you know, they comment on whatever the mind-body problem or something or consciousness or all sorts of things. Again, I'm not overselling this result of Gödel's incompleteness theorems. It gets cited all over the place. This is one of the most famous results when it comes to just epistemology, let's say, like, you know, this the study of knowledge and how do we know anything. This is an incredibly important, powerful result. And also what's neat about it is just the way he proved it is mind-boggling. Okay, so I really, if you're tempted, you know what, you know, Bob, I was with you for the economics, but I'll come back when you interview somebody. Good luck with this stuff. I implore you not to dismiss it like that. Give it a chance. If you just stick with me through this, folks, I'm telling you, it is really cool. And so, because I'm so happy to do it and excited to do it, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do it right now. Why wait? I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. All right. One other thing here is, if you're willing to read mathematicians talk about it, there are books that you can get. And I was looking online to see if there's anything on YouTube. So I did find one that's pretty good. It's by this, the account's called Numberphile, P-H-I-L-E. And I'll, of course, link to that, where this is right now, episode 7. So all these links are going to be at bobmurphyshow.com/7. And so I'll put those links there, but it's, they're really, the reason I'm doing this, again, not because I'm some mathematical genius, but I spent a long time trying to nail this thing down. Because when I was younger, the way it was presented, and this is what I meant earlier when I said a lot of these people talking about it, they don't really know what it did. And so when they paraphrase, they don't quite get it right. And then somebody who's relying upon those secondhand expositions then ends up thinking the thing is wrong. Okay. And so I'm not going to waste all of our time by walking down the wrong way to think about it. I just remember that when I was an undergrad, for example, the philosophy of mind class in particular, reading people talking about it, and they were saying how it was, Gödel had shown that certain mathematical propositions were undecidable or something, or could not be decided. And now that I know what he did, I get what they're saying, and that's totally fine, and I'm not doing justice right now to, but it was sort of ambiguous the way they would talk about it, and then that would make you think, well, wait a minute, this doesn't even sound like it's right, or you'd think it was trivial. All right, and so what I'm trying to do here is to give you an intuitive understanding of what he did, and so if you get it, you're going to be like, whoa, because it's amazing the way this thing works and what he proved. It's unexpected. But yet, I won't have to bring in all sorts of technical jargon, okay? Because that's the problem that, like I say, there were very intuitive statements of it, but yet they didn't have enough rigor and they didn't go into the proof enough so that if that's all you had, you'd say, I don't even know if this thing is true or this sounds like it's goofy. Whereas, of course, there were full-blown sketches of the proof that involved all sorts of details that would just make your eyes glaze over if you weren't already a trained mathematician. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to do with this podcast episode, is to find some middle ground there where I give you enough rigor that you really see what he did, but also don't overwhelm you with jargon. Okay, so let me, to motivate this, so you just understand, okay, how do I want to spend the next 40 minutes of my life here listening to this guy? Let me try to motivate it. What Gödel showed is that if you have an axiomatic system that's powerful enough to contain propositions about arithmetic, then you can construct a true statement about numbers using that axiomatic framework or that system. So you can write out a true mathematical statement, but you can't use the axioms of the system to prove that the statement is true. Okay, so different ways of expressing that are to say, Gödel showed that with modern mathematics, there are statements that are true in modern mathematics that we will never be able to prove are true. Okay, so just stop for a minute and just let that sink in. That's a very powerful thing. And perhaps to you, you're like, well, what do I care? But that's a... It was sort of a nail in the coffin, or at least a lot of people thought so, to what had been the attempt to put everything on firm foundations. Okay, so that, and you see this in every field of inquiry. Okay, so even like in economics, just to give you something to grab a hold of, for those of you who have an economics background, that you may have heard of the attempt in the 70s and 80s to take macroeconomics and give it micro foundations, right? And so the idea is there that, yeah, we have these results that kind of work, like the ISLM model or just, you know, aggregate supply area demand. But we would feel better about the whole thing if these top-level results, if we could somehow reduce it to more primitive things that we're more sure about, like we understand how incentives affect an individual's behavior. And then if we could build up the whole business cycle from things that we're more certain of, then that would just be more satisfying, wouldn't it? We'd be more confident in the result, and it would just be intellectually more appealing aesthetically pleasing. So likewise with mathematics, there were a bunch of propositions about math. By the way, in this thing, I'm going to be going to like propositions about numbers, or I'll say statements in math, and I'm going to be pretty loose with this terminology. So feel free, for those of you who are more formally trained, if you want to leave comments and say, you know, Bob, actually at 1834, you said this, and that's a little bit off. Fine, go ahead, and I welcome that feedback, but here I'm trying to present this to somebody who doesn't have a math background. So mathematicians had been developing all sorts of lines of analysis, making discoveries about numbers and just mathematical topics, but they didn't all rest on axioms. And so what we mean here, just to give you something real obvious, just to make sure you're thinking about this the right way, probably a lot of you have heard of the following proof, where you say, okay, assumption one, all men are mortal. Assumption two, Socrates was a man. Conclusion, Socrates is mortal, right? So in that demonstration, you could say the first axiom was that all men are mortal. The second axiom was Socrates is a man. And then the theorem relying on those axioms is that Socrates is mortal, okay? So that's the way we want to do stuff in mathematics. And the best example of that is Euclidean geometry. So in Euclidean geometry, you've got something that's pretty paradigmatic for this, where you have axioms and then you prove propositions about geometric figures and, you know, something like the Pythagorean theorem. So what does it mean? How do you prove stuff in geometry? So the Pythagorean theorem, you know, picture a right triangle, and it's saying that the square of the length of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides. All right, so again, you got a right triangle that you drew out, and the lengths are A, B, and C, and the C is the long one. And so C squared equals A squared plus B squared, right? That's the Pythagorean theorem. And so how do you prove that? What does it mean in math to say you prove something? It doesn't mean that you take out a ruler and you go around measuring triangles and you got to make sure, oh, wait a minute, this wasn't perfectly a right triangle, so that's why the theorem doesn't apply. That's not what you do. You don't go and measure thousands and thousands of triangles to see, can we find any counterexamples to this? And if you don't, well, after a while, geez, this is probably true. That's not what it means to prove something in math. That, incidentally, is how we go about empirical science, by the way. You know, like, oh, the speed of light, such and such. Well, we can't really prove that the way we can prove something in math. All we really mean is, well, we haven't ever seen an example of it not being that speed. Okay, so what does it mean to prove something in Euclidean geometry? You start out with axioms, and then you use valid steps to sort of transform them into new propositions. Okay, so here I'm especially verbally, I'm not going to be able to convey it very well, but the idea is the axioms of Euclidean geometry, and there's different types you could use, but you can have an axiomatic system, and then you have things that are very unobjectionable, right? Really simple things. Like, how would you define, what do you mean by a point? Or what's a line? Or what do you mean by an angle or an interior angle? Okay, so I'm being loose here, but that's the kind of thing that you can draw stuff and show somebody, and they might be like, oh yeah, I get what you're saying, but you know, mathematicians over the years, we're really concerned about, let's make this rigorous. Let's not just smuggle in our intuitive judgments that maybe we're biased or something. You know, let's really make sure this is rigorous and airtight. And so let's break it down into really, really unobjectionable axioms that nobody could possibly deny or doubt. And then can we build up things step by step from those axioms? You know, using rules that also are completely unobjectionable. No one could possibly, like, this is just how a rational mind has to work, is to agree with these things, you know, these basic axioms, and then let's build up stuff from there, right? And so then once you prove a theorem in that axiomatic framework, that's airtight. So just a quick sketch, instead of going around measuring triangles to see, does that C squared equals A squared plus B squared, does that always hold for right triangles? What you do is you can sort of prove it. Like, imagine drawing a one triangle like that, and then you draw an exact duplicate of it, but you kind of rotate it, and then you connect them, so now they're a rectangle. Okay, so you can start seeing, like, that's the path you might go down to start, you know, doing that. Or you cut the thing up and move it around to turn it into a square, that kind of stuff. Right, so there's ways you can start slicing and dicing the thing in order to transform it into a square, and then now you start to see where the squares come into play. And okay, so that's the way you can do it, to show you give me an arbitrary right triangle, and I can prove to you for an arbitrary a squared, b squared, and c squared that that equation has to hold. Okay, so that's the way you would prove it. And so if you do walk somebody through that, you can show them, look, I did this for any old triangle. It wasn't a particular one. It was a generic one, and I can show you how I can prove it. All right. So the person understood the proof, then they would say, okay, yep, that's true. That's got to be true for any triangle satisfying those conditions. Incidentally, there's a whole other thing of non-Euclidean geometry where those axioms aren't true. Things like, you know, the interior angles of a triangle do not sum to 180 degrees, stuff like that. And the way it works is, like, the lines are, they look curved. All right, so that's how that works. And so there, like, what's the definition of a line? You know, that kind of stuff. So that's what we mean. So we're trying not to smuggle in our own preconceptions. So you can say, well, gee, what if a line was like this? Okay, so that's what we mean by an axiomatic system. And so the goal of math, or many mathematicians, they thought the progress was going to be that they were going to sort of work backwards and build really airtight axiomatic foundations for the whole edifice of mathematics, so that ultimately everything could be proved, you know, by tracing it back to these really complete, unobjectionable axioms. And they also thought it went the other way, that, you know, once we've got these axioms that we think are great and airtight, now within that system, any statement about numbers ought to be either provable within that framework, that, like, a proof in principle must exist, or you could prove the opposite of the statement. All right, so for example, you know, something like there is no prime number higher than 2 quadrillion, right? That's a statement, and we think that surely that's either true or false. Okay, now you say, what do you mean that's true or false? I mean, as opposed to me saying the Beatles were the best band ever, you can see how some people might say, you know what, there's not obviously a truth value assigned to that. You know, or they might try to say, let's rephrase it to say Bob Murphy thinks that the Beatles were the best band. You see what I'm saying? How that type of statement, a lot of people would pull back from and not be sure whether it even has a truth value objectively. Okay, and by the way, I'm not endorsing that or denying it. I'm just saying we can see how that kind of a statement might make people think, wait a minute, I don't know if I want to go down that path and say that thing has a truth value. But surely a statement like there's no prime number higher than 2 quadrillion, surely we think that's either true or false. Like, that's, there's got to be a truth value to that. And so what people like Hilbert and others were proposing, the vision they had for math was that ultimately one day, you know, we will have a set of axioms that you could take and transform step by step to produce any true proposition about mathematics in that syntax, in the language of that axiomatic system. And the other way, that if a statement is false, then we should be able to prove the opposite of it. Okay, so that's the idea. And so that would be like a complete system. Another word to throw around here to bring up is consistent. So an axiomatic system is consistent if it doesn't contain any contradictions. So you better not be able to prove a proposition P and also prove not P, or the negation of P, right? Because then you'd have P and not P both being true within the system. That's a contradiction. Okay, so if you were able to do that, if you were able to take the axioms and transform them using the valid rules in this system, and you were able to prove that the proposition P is true and you could also prove that not P is true, then that system's inconsistent, and that's bad. We don't want to have inconsistencies. Okay, we don't want math generating contradictions. And we don't think that it does. And this, again, I'm going to try to contain the podcast here, the content, keep this episode manageable. But that's a whole other area where it's almost spiritual. Like, there's a lot of mathematicians, I think, that if it somehow turned out that math contained a contradiction, I think they would commit suicide. And I'm not engaging in hyperbole. I mean, they might not go jump off a bridge, but they might, like, you know, start abusing drugs and whatever just to, because they couldn't live anymore. In the sense that, like, if, you know, some devout Christian all of a sudden seriously doubted the existence of God. Like, I think that's how much it would strike certain mathematicians if it were demonstrated that math contained a contradiction. Like, that's how much they believe in the purity of it. Okay, so we sort of hope and pray that mathematics, you know, that we've been fumbling around it and discovering, very, you know, we've been charting its territory, as it were, over the centuries. And that's been an underlying assumption, right? That we kind of assume that it doesn't contain a contradiction. Otherwise, what are we wasting our time for? Okay, but strictly speaking, you know, if you're going to really push the Darwinian envelope and so forth, you know, it's conceivable. Anyway, so that's a whole separate discussion. Maybe we'll go into that in future episodes. But for right now, what I'm saying is that that's certainly the only system we want to work with is one that's internally consistent. Okay, let me now say that the way we're going to use the word prove from now on in this episode is going to be in the technical sense, meaning within an axiomatic system. To prove a proposition means you start with the axioms and you perform operations on them, or you transform them step by step to generate conclusions within the system. And then that means you proved that conclusion. If you can take the axioms and validly do stuff to them to then end up with that proposition, then that means you prove the proposition within the axiomatic system. It doesn't mean that the proposition is true. And so that's where I might be throwing you, and that's why I'm just mentioning this right now up front before I forget. So again, in this episode, if I say within a formal system you prove something, that doesn't mean that I'm saying it actually is true. Okay, so real simple example. Axiom number one says all men are immortal. Axiom number two says Socrates is a man. Therefore, I can prove the theorem Socrates is immortal. Is that true? Is Socrates immortal? No, he's not. That's a false statement. And so the problem was the axiom here was false. Okay, so just notice that kind of thing. If at least one of your axioms is false, then that can lead to trouble. All right, but the way we're going to use words in this episode, I would just say, in that axiomatic system, I proved Socrates was immortal. So I proved a false statement. So you could say that axiomatic system is inconsistent. Now, part of the trick here and what Gödel's going to do in this proof, it's very similar to the old paradox that I'm sure many of you have heard, where you can have like something written on a sheet of paper that says, this sentence is false. Or somebody might be talking to you and say, I am lying to you right now. And so let's just stop for a minute and think about that, because it's important. So you're reading a note card on which is written the words, this statement is false. Okay, so that's a paradox, because if the statement is false, right? So let's walk through this. So the statement, it's either true or false, right? Like that's the approach we're going to take initially, is we're going to say, well, it's got to have a truth value, so it's either true or false, right? Because just because a statement has a truth value doesn't mean it has to be true, right? I could say, my name is Jesse Ventura. There's a truth value of that statement, it's false. If Jesse Ventura says that same statement, it's true. Okay, so there's nothing scandalous about a sentence being false. What's weird, though, about this particular one was that this statement is false. Let's try to evaluate the truthity or falsehood of that statement itself. So if it's true, right? Let's just try that first. Let's assume it's true. So the statement says this statement is false. So if it's true, then that means it is in fact the case that this statement is false. Wait a minute. So if we assume it's true, we end up proving it's false, and that's a contradiction. Okay, so maybe we rescue ourselves by saying, okay, well, maybe it's not true. Maybe it's false. Okay, so if the statement is false, that means we're going to negate what it says and then believe in that, right? So the statement says that this statement is false, but we're assuming that that utterance itself is incorrect, so we'll negate it. So instead, this statement is true. Did you see what happened? If we assume the statement's false, we end up concluding that it's true. Again, a contradiction. Okay, so that's why it's a paradox. Whether we assume it's true or false, the statement then ends up proving the opposite of what we initially assumed, and we generate a contradiction. So it's a cute, fun little thing, but it's not like linguists were paralyzed when somebody discovered this little trick. And we're walking around just in a day saying my life is meaningless now because language, human spoken language, can generate paradoxes. Nobody cares. They say, that's kind of funny. They move on with their life because you just sort of say, well, that's goofy. It doesn't seem like it means anything. I don't care. We'll use normal language to talk about things. Just avoid these little self-referential traps and you're fine. Okay, so that's kind of how people moved on and they don't really care. And it's just a little parlor trick. But Gödel is going to do something like that, but with numbers, where the statement is going to be as objective as saying something like, there are no prime numbers higher than 2 quadrillion. By the way, that's a false statement, in case you don't know. There's an infinite number of primes. There is no such thing as the highest prime number. All right, so that's a false statement that I've been using, just to illustrate. But the point is, you think that should be either true or false. It's not like you're just going to say, oh, come on, that's goofy. Real math doesn't need to worry about silly statements like that. The way you could say linguists can just, they don't need to worry when you're writing up grammar books and stuff. The idea of a sentence saying this statement is false, it's not like the people doing the style books and the grammar books and the dictionaries and whatever have to just be like, oh my gosh, we're living a lie. They don't care. Whereas mathematicians, if a statement like there's no prime number higher than 2 quadrillion, if it turns out that statements like that generate paradoxes or something, like that would be a serious deal, right? Because that's the very type of statement that should be included in mathematical discourse. Okay, so that's, again, what I'm saying. It's a, again, contrast it to say 2 + 2 = 4. We feel that needs to have a truth value much more than to say the Beatles were the best band ever or this statement is false. Okay, that's what I'm trying to hammer home here, that Gödel uses this same rhetorical ploy of self-referential statements, but the way he actually did it, and this was the part of the genius of what he did, was not to make it like a verbal semantic trick that just seems like a play on words. Quite literally, instead, it was propositions about numbers, about integers. And so that's what was part of the genius of what he did. And so you really can't just sweep it away and say, come on, this is goofy. Like, this is a very serious thing that he showed. Okay, so how did he do it? The first thing that he had to do was come up with a way of taking statements within an axiomatic framework and turning them into an integer. So by integer, I mean like 1, 2, 3, 4, things that don't have decimals. Okay. And so, and the way he did it is like any sentence you could write out, any proposition in mathematics within this system, you could then just like for each component of it, you could assign a number to it and then multiply all those numbers together to come up with one big number. Okay, so I'm going to breeze through that element of it here, partly because it's technical and partly because I don't want to waste too much time. I don't think it's essential, but the idea is any proposition, whether it's true or false, that you could write in mathematics within the framework that you're trying to devise or build. Gödel showed how you can take that proposition and assign it to a unique integer. Okay, so again, every proposition is going to have a unique integer assigned to it. And so you might be able to come up with stuff like this. So maybe proposition number 5 says 2 + 2 = 4. And maybe proposition number 8,347 says there are an infinite number of primes. Okay, so I'm just making up stuff obviously here. But the idea is you'd have, in principle, you could list the propositions of the system. Okay, so now the next thing he does is he shows how you could say whether a certain proposition could be deduced from the axioms, and that itself would be a statement about numbers. Okay, and so here I'm going to be a little bit loose, but I'll try to give you enough intuition. So again, let's say proposition 5 is the proposition that 2 + 2 = 4. Okay, so again, 2 + 2 = 4, the system Gödel uses to encode and give that proposition a number, you plug it in, and the number 5 pops out. And so sentence number 5 is the following, 2 + 2 = 4. And so now is a separate statement somewhere else, maybe statement number 60,000,000,000,006, just to throw that in there. Maybe statement 60,000,000,006 says statement 5 can be deduced from the axioms. And so that is equivalent to saying statement 5 is true, or 2 + 2 = 4 is a true statement. And specifically, the way he did it is he's going to say what statement 60,000,000,006 really said is there exists a sequence of operations we could perform on the axioms to generate statement number 5. Okay, and that's what it means to be able to prove a statement within an axiomatic framework, is to say, can you take the initial axioms, do valid things to them, and then generate a statement? And if so, well, that's what it means to prove something in the axiomatic framework. Okay, so again, what statement 60,000,000,006 was saying was a statement about numbers. Because remember, all this stuff can ultimately reduce to numbers. So to say you could do valid operations to the axioms to then generate statement number 5, that itself is just a proposition concerning numbers. And again, here I'm being a little bit loose with it because I think it would be too hard to go into the details. But that's the idea. Okay, so the statement, proposition 60,000,000,006, that says statement 5 can be deduced from the axioms, that is just as low level and basic and primitive and fundamental as saying 2 + 2 = 4. Okay, even though the way I'm talking to you now, you might think, no, Bob, 2 + 2 = 4, that is an objective statement about numbers that, you know, Martians would agree with or whatever. I mean, that's a really raw, primitive thing about math, whereas to talk about it can be proven, now that's getting a little loosey-goosey, and I'm saying that's only because of the way I'm paraphrasing here, that what Gödel showed is, no, if you, the sense in which it better be the case that we can assign a truth value, that 2 + 2 = 4, that's either true or false, or there's no prime numbers higher than 2 quadrillion, that's either true or false, or, you know, other propositions in mathematics that we don't know whether it's true or false, but we know it's got to be one or the other. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. Likewise, what Gödel showed is he came up with a way to talk about the process of proving results in an axiomatic framework such that it was really just a statement about numbers. That if it were possible to take the axioms and transform them into proposition 5, then that would go hand in hand with a statement about numbers. All right, and so that's what he showed. Okay, so now, let me just give you some examples just to make sure you're getting it. We're real close here to the punchline for the first incompleteness theorem. So remember, we've got proposition number 5 says 2 + 2 = 4. Let's add proposition 6 that says 2 + 2 = 5, right? Why not? And so now we've got proposition 60 trillion and six that says proposition 5 can be deduced from the axioms. And more specifically, it says there exists a set of operations on the axioms that would produce proposition 5. Okay, so that's, so now in our list of statements, we say, proposition 5 has a truth value, and it's true according to proposition 60 trillion and 6. Okay. Proposition 6, remember, says 2 + 2 = 5. So we all know that's false. And we look at our system, and oh, and maybe statement 80 quadrillion says proposition 6, it could say cannot be, or there does not exist a way to transform the axioms into proposition 6. And maybe a different proposition says that not proposition 6 can be derived from the axioms. So then we would be able to know that proposition 6 was false. Okay, so that's the idea. So it's okay to write out false sentences or propositions in this framework. That's totally fine. Just like in math, it's syntactically correct to say 3 + 7 = 22. That's a false statement, but you know what I am claiming, and it just happens to be false, right? Okay. So that's the way these things work. So again, in an axiomatic framework, it's fine to be able to express false propositions using the syntax or the grammar of the system. That's fine. It's just that you want to make sure you couldn't use the axioms to have that false statement pop out. You'd want the false statement to not be derivable from the axioms. And then if the thing is going to be complete, what you want is that you could actually derive the negation of a false sentence from the axioms, that you could prove the thing was false, okay? All right, so here's what Gödel did. He showed that with any system that contained basic arithmetic and was powerful enough to say things like, there exists a number X such that, right? Or there does not exist a number X such that, right? To make propositions, those are what are called quantifiers. If you had that much power to be able to make propositions like that, then Gödel showed he can always construct a statement that says something like, statement number 1, 2, 3 cannot be derived from the axioms. Right? Or more concretely, there does not exist a procedure to transform the axioms into statement number 1, 2, 3. And I'm just picking 1, 2, 3 to remember the number, obviously. Okay? And so then you're like, that's interesting. Okay. Well, what is, just for kicks, that statement we just said, what number does that happen to be? Right? Because remember, with the earlier examples I was using, like statement 5 was saying 2 + 2 = 4, and then it was statement 60 trillion plus 6 that said statement 5 can be deduced from the axioms, right? So the statement talking about the proof was a different one. So here, I'm sure you guys see where this is going. What Gödel did is he said, the statement that says statement number 1, 2, 3 cannot be derived from the axioms, when you throw that into the formula to generate, to encode, to break down that thing by its component parts, multiply them all together and come up with what's the integer that Gödel will assign to this statement, it's 1, 2, 3. And again, I'm saying 1, 2, 3 in the real one, the numbers are humongous. Okay. So statement 1, 2, 3 says statement 1, 2, 3 cannot be derived from the axioms. Okay. Fair enough. And again, I'm using natural language here, but it's really just a proposition about numbers. And so what we have here is a statement about numbers, so it's got to be true or false. That's the critical thing, and that's why I keep emphasizing that distinction. It's not something like the Beatles were the best band ever. It's something like 2 + 2 = 4, right? That's the level in terms of this is a statement about numbers, even though we're talking about what does it mean, and we're saying it's about being able to prove something. But ultimately, it is literally just a statement about numbers, saying like there exists a number such that these properties are true and da-da-da-da-da, right? Because again, that's the genius of how Gödel constructed this system. Hey folks, let's take a break for a second from the walkthrough of Gödel's incompleteness theorems, and let me mention in January, I'm going to be walking through my book, The Three Lads and the Lizard King. And so I want to give you time to go ahead and get a copy and read it, because that'll make much more sense as I go through it in January and tell you what I was doing with this book. So what it is, it's this actually the five-year anniversary, I just realized. So it came out in December of 2013. And it was a short story I wrote for my son. And as I came up with the story and was walking through it, I said, you know what, this is actually, instead of me just typing it out or something and reading it to him, why don't I go ahead and make an actual booklet out of it with illustrations and so forth, because I thought other people might like it as well. So here, let me just read to you from some of the reviews on Amazon. They're all five-star reviews, by the way. Here's one guy. I happen to know him, but I won't use his name here. He says, I must say I was pleasantly surprised. Not that I expected Bob to do a poor job, but I'm thinking it's a story for 8 to 10-year-olds. How interesting can it be for a 40-something-year-old? Thankfully, my skepticism was shattered. Each chapter was a page-turner. As each chapter ended, I had no choice but to proceed to the next. Okay, skipping around. Somebody else says, not only does it teach solid economics, it's a good story too. Kids love it. One person says, my kids love this story. Somebody else says, this is awesome. I read this to my girls and they loved it and learned from it. It was super well written. I mean, I don't know what more I need to tell you guys. But in all seriousness, this is something where you might, oh, yeah, it's a cute little story for his son. I really did put, you know, in other words, I was trying to think of, these are the lessons I want to pass along to him right now. And so I'm not engaging in hyperbole when I say, if any of my books were going to be save for future generations as the representative of, here's what I tried to do to help people with the things I've grappled with and stumbled upon, certainly word for word, it would be this. Okay. That the other books, you know, they're longer, so that might be unfair, but clearly for the amount of pages this thing is, I think I boiled down what I wanted to try to show my son. So if you're curious about that, I would encourage you to get the book. And then, like I say, in January, at some point, on one of these podcast episodes, I'll just walk through and explain what I was doing in certain areas, because I didn't waste any of the scenes, put it that way. I really was doing something quite intentional with every stage of that book. So where do you go to get your copy? Go to bobmurphyshow.com/lizard. Okay, so we've got this proposition that says this proposition itself cannot be derived from the axioms. And we'll call that the Gödel sentence, or the Gödel statement, sometimes people call it. So it's got to be true or false, one or the other. So let's say that it is false. Okay. So if it were false, and the statement's claiming that this statement can't be derived from the axioms, well, if that's false, then that means the statement can be derived from the axioms. Oh, but wait a minute. That means we just derived a false statement from the axioms, right? Because remember, we initially said, hey, let's just assume it's false and see what happens. Well, that's a no-no. So that means we'd be working with an axiomatic system of mathematics, and we were able to derive a proposition in that system from the axioms that we now know is false. So we don't want that to happen. So we say, okay, that can't be it. Because if it were, that would mean mathematics had an inconsistency, a contradiction in it. So that can't be true. And when I say it can't be, I just mean like we're going to say, well, we don't want that to be true. That can't be it. Okay. So if we're working with a system that has no internal contradictions, the fact that Gödel showed I can always generate this Gödel sentence, we just showed, well, it can't be false because then there'd be a contradiction. So if the system is to be consistent, we must conclude this statement has to be true. Because those are the only two options. It's either true or false. We just showed if it's false, we get a contradiction. We don't like that. Okay, so it's got to be true. But again, the proposition says, the Gödel sentence says, this sentence or this proposition cannot be derived from the axioms. And now we sort of backed ourselves into a corner saying, if mathematics is to be consistent, then that statement's true. And so now look at that. It's a true statement about integers that we can't ever derive from the axioms of the system. So notice here, we're not merely saying right now we don't know. All right, so clearly, there's a bunch of theorems right now in math that we don't know whether they're true or false. Or, you know, a bunch of propositions. Some people might say, well, it's not a theorem if it's false. But you get the point. There's a bunch of claims, and some of them are quite provocative and powerful. And they would do a lot of work, as it were, if we could prove that they were true. Like, or other people have proven things saying, if this one guy's conjecture turns out to be true, look at all these implications. Okay, but we're not sure right now. Is the thing true or false? We don't know, but we assume it's one or the other. Like, that's just kind of how it works. Okay, so again, what Gödel showed here is not merely, oh, hey, you know what? At any given time, there's going to be some theorems that we haven't yet proven. I mean, that's obvious. Anybody could tell you that. That's not the point. The point is he showed, in principle, this Gödel sentence cannot be derived from the axioms. So it's not just a matter of time. This is a very powerful result. You know, sort of like, I don't know if I'm going to make things worse with this analogy, but when Einstein, you know, in special relativity, say something can't go faster than light, you know, some people hear that initially, go, oh, well, you know what, though? I mean, scientists, they really work on that. You know, maybe in the year 2030. And you're saying, okay, but no, you're not getting it. It's not a statement about how engines work. It's a statement about the laws of physics. Okay, so if they ever do have something go faster than light, it's going to be because of a loophole in relativity. It's not going to be because the engineers really put their heads together. Okay, so it's likewise here. Just to make sure you're getting it. It's not merely that, oh, yeah, there's certain things that, man, that would be a tough nut to crack. No, it's saying, in principle, this statement, even though it's about numbers, and even though there's a sense in which we, from the outside, backed ourselves into a corner and said, we think that that's got to be true, yet within the system itself, we can never prove that it's true. Okay, so that's the main result, and you can see why. Eventually, that had such far-reaching consequences, reverberations, not just in math, but in other related fields, because it was showing the built-in limitations of axiomatic sort of foundational projects, because you would think if an axiomatic approach is going to work anywhere, surely it would be in arithmetic, right? Just dealing with propositions about integers and things like that. I mean, give me a break. If you can't reduce all true propositions into an axiomatic framework where at least in principle a proof would exist for all true propositions and that it doesn't contain any contradictions, then what hope is there to extend that approach elsewhere? Okay, so that's what the main result was. Now, I'll move more quickly. Gödel's second incompleteness theorem in words says that if you have a consistent system, meaning, you know, you've got an axiomatic framework, and again, with these things that we're assuming it's got the ability to generate statements about arithmetic of a certain level of power, if it's powerful enough to make certain statements about arithmetic and it's internally consistent, then you can never use that framework to prove its own consistency. Okay, so notice that's not what I said before. That's not the same thing. The first, Gödel's first incompleteness theorem just said there are, in a sufficiently powerful axiomatic framework, there are true propositions that cannot be proven within the framework. Whereas this is now saying if you had that framework and it's consistent, meaning it doesn't generate contradictions within that framework, you can never prove its own consistency. Okay, so now the proof of the second incompleteness theorem relies on the fact that we already proved the first one. So again, we've got an axiomatic system that's sufficiently powerful to make claims about arithmetic, you know, that include things like there does not exist or there does exist. And we know in such a framework, we can always generate a Gödel sentence. So statement number 1, 2, 3 says statement 1, 2, 3 cannot be derived from the axioms. All right, so we can always generate a sentence like that. That's what the first incompleteness theorem told us. Now, the second incompleteness theorem is saying we can't, an internally consistent system cannot prove its own consistency. So how are we going to do a proof by contradiction? We're going to assume that it could and then show that that leads to a contradiction. Okay, so we've got a system that's internally consistent. Now let's assume that we could, within that system, prove its own consistency. Okay, so now we've got the Gödel sentence floating around in there because we know that exists. But we also are armed with the knowledge that we can prove the system's consistency. So that means now, within the framework of the system, if I know that it can't generate inconsistent statements, then it can't be the case that we could demonstrate that the Gödel sentence is false, right? because if we could demonstrate that it was false, and remember the sentence is saying this sentence cannot be derived from the axioms, that means it could be derived from the axioms. And so we would have just generated a false statement from the axioms, but that contradicts the assumption that we have a consistent system. Okay, so that means we know it can't be false, so therefore it's got to be true. And remember, what the proposition is saying is this statement cannot be proven from the elements of the system, the axiom of the system. And now we just thought, we can prove that it's true. Because if it were false, that would lead to a contradiction, and we can prove that there are no contradictions within this framework. Therefore, we can rule out it being false. Therefore, it must be true. Wait a minute. That means we just use the axioms in this system to prove that the Gödel sentence is true. But we can't do that. The whole point is the Gödel sentence is saying this can't be proven from the axioms. So that's another contradiction. All right. And so that's why if you start out with an axiomatic system that's internally consistent and sufficiently powerful to generate a Gödel sentence, if you then try to assume on top of that, and let's assume also that with these axioms, we were able to prove this system's own internal consistency. If we take that step, we generate a contradiction because of that Gödel sentence. So that means we can't, it cannot be the case that the system of such, of adequate power could also prove its own internal consistency. All right, so that's the proof of the second incompleteness theorem. So again, the summary, the first incompleteness theorem said for sufficiently powerful axiomatic systems, you're always going to be able to generate a sentence that says this statement cannot be proven from the axioms. And then the second incompleteness theorem says any internally consistent, sufficiently powerful axiomatic framework cannot demonstrate its own consistency. By the way, let me just mention as an aside, just so you're tracking this right, because it helped me when I thought about this on my own and in the Wikipedia write-up. They said that there as well, so it confirmed that, okay, yeah, I'm thinking about this right. It's no big deal if an axiomatic framework produces a proof saying, this system doesn't generate any contradictions, right? So in other words, the point of us wondering, could a system prove its own consistency? Don't get misled by that verb prove. Again, this is going back and forth between the way we use that verb when we're talking about an axiomatic framework versus everyday usage, where we say, if you prove something, that means it's true. Whereas, again, in these axiomatic frameworks, we just mean, no, it just means it's derivable from the axioms. Okay, so just because within an axiomatic framework, you could prove that the framework is consistent, meaning you're proving that this framework doesn't generate contradictions, that by itself doesn't make us trust in the system. Because if it were an inconsistent system, if you had chosen axioms that did generate contradictions, one of the propositions that would pop out of that thing is the statement, this framework doesn't generate contradictions. And you'd be able to derive that from the axioms. And then you'd say, but wait a minute, I could derive a contradiction over here. So isn't that wrong? Yes, that's contradictory, but that's the whole point. An inconsistent framework generates contradictory propositions. It proves P and not P. So one of the things that it would, quote, prove is to say this framework doesn't generate or doesn't prove false statements. But that itself would be a false statement. Okay, so it's if you want to switch it to humans, just to make sure you're getting the point, somebody who's a liar could come up to you and say, I never lie. And that's, not a thing. But if what we're saying is that, even an honest person, no matter how much he talked to you, could never prove to you that he was always honest or something like that. That's kind of what we're getting at here. So it's not the surprising thing about this. It's not the claim, we would never just look at a system to see, can we prove the statement that this is consistent? That's not what we're looking for. The point is not to have the system prove its consistency to us, and then that makes us trust it. Because again, if it were inconsistent, it would generate such a statement. So again, with an analogy with people, if someone comes up to you and says, oh, I assure you, I never lie, that right there doesn't convince us that, oh, this person must be impeccable. What it's saying, though, is that even if it were an axiomatic system that was free from internal contradictions and the axioms were such that they would only generate true statements about numbers, that in such a framework, we could not prove that those axioms wouldn't generate contradictions. So we think it's a true statement that they wouldn't, right? So that, again, that's a statement about the system. Its consistency we think is true. It's just you could never prove it within the system. And so this has to do with, you know, the attempts to like build nested hierarchies of axiomatic frameworks. And could you prove something, you know, if you had a framework that you are more certain of, could you use that to prove the consistency of a different framework? That's where this stuff comes into play. But anyway, that's the first and second incompleteness theorems from Gödel. Now you might wonder, okay, but are these all just little verbal tricks about Gödel sentences? That's an obvious thing. And I wondered this too when I first heard about this stuff. In other words, yeah, it's neat that he could say, ah, this statement cannot be provable or cannot be derived from the axioms. Great. But is it just those kind of self-referential little tricks, or are there more serious things involved? So number one, again, I cannot stress this enough. You really can't just dismiss it as a verbal trick because it's not using spoken language. What Gödel showed is that these are propositions about numbers, about integers. It would be like saying, you know, oh, well, the proposition 900 is evenly divisible by 27. You know, that's something that we can never know the truth or falsehood of that. That'll never, you know, that's just something humans will be incapable of ever deciding one way or the other. Like, that would be weird, wouldn't it? And so that's the level of what he's showing here, that even these apparently irrelevant, quixotic curiosities of these Gödel sentences, it's hard to just brush them aside and say, oh, they don't mean anything, because again, they're statements about numbers. And you would have thought, before Gödel showed us this stuff, you would have thought that clearly, or surely I should say, that, you know, statements about numbers are either true or false, and then you can either derive them from the axioms if they're true, at least in principle. You'd think there'd be a way to do that, and no, there's not. But beyond that, there have been results where this stuff comes into play affecting our ability to prove things that are clearly, like, quote, real math problems. And so specifically it has to do with what's called the Paris-Harrington theorem. And here, you know, I'm now beyond the level of my competence. I'll put a link in the show notes page if you want to go look at that. But my point is, this isn't just merely a verbal curiosity or something, a little quirk, that mathematicians have now shown that these sorts of issues are bleeding into genuine research that, you know, didn't start out with these kind of questions. This is just, yes, this does have implications. It's not just some cute little thing that doesn't have any impact on how mathematicians proceed. Last couple things I'll mention. Apparently, so again, this is a humongous result that's cited all over the place. You know, it's arguably one of the most important discoveries, or whatever you want to call it, inventions, depending on your view, of the 20th century. And it's math, right? It's not like when the Beatles go on audition and then, you know, they get rejected, or Harry Potter, that manuscript got sent around to a lot of places before someone picked it up. This is math. You would think that this is pretty straightforward stuff, that people would recognize the importance. But apparently the story goes that Gödel first presented this in 1930 at a conference, and that later the notes of, like, the person who typed up summarizing what had, you know, the papers that had been presented at this conference, they didn't even mention Gödel's presentation. That's how much under the radar this was, that people didn't even get what he just did, that they didn't even think afterward it was worth even mentioning it, you know, when the people were summarizing what happened at this conference. And I have read that von Neumann was there. John von Neumann was, you know, this polymath, really brilliant guy. And then apparently he went up and saw Gödel's presentation, and at least he knew enough to say, whoa, what is this? And went up and was talking to him afterward. And, you know, at least von Neumann got that this was something really deep that this guy just presented, whereas everybody else wasn't even on their radar. So, again, just to show you how stuff like that works, that even something as, quote, objective as math. I mean, it wasn't that people in the crowd thought what he presented was false. They just didn't think it was important. They didn't realize it because it was so important. It was so fundamental and it was so counterintuitive that just they didn't even get it, what it was. And it took, you know, a while just to sink in. And now lots of people cite it, even though not as many people go through and actually research the thing. And the last thing I'll end on here is there's this anecdote where Gödel was coming over to the United States, I think, to, you know, get naturalized or something. And Einstein was his sponsor. And, you know, that's a pretty big gun to have in your camp. And the story goes that they were, when he's going through the, you know, the process and answering questions about, you know, like the citizenship test or whatever. And, you know, the guy's making some reference about Nazi Germany or something and dictatorship and says that, yeah, well, luckily nothing like that can ever happen here, meaning the United States. And Gödel apparently said something like, oh, no, well, there's actually a loophole in your constitution that I discovered. And, you know, Einstein's like, dude, kicking him. So I'm sure that story has been morphed over the years, but that's the basic gist. And I will, last thing I'll put in the show notes page is I did find somebody who wrote up, because I heard that anecdote and I've been looking around, like I couldn't figure out what did Gödel think, you know, what was the contradiction or the flaw or the loophole in the constitution that would allow for dictatorship. And, you know, there it would be it wouldn't just be like, well, they would just ignore it. You know, I get that, folks. But my point is Gödel clearly, he had, you know, some real logical thing like, no, assuming that this is the framework, there's this problem right here. So I did find a paper where someone claims that they, you know, wrote up what Gödel had found, if you're curious. Well, that's the end of our episode this time. Thank you for listening in, and I hope that broadened your horizons. We will probably have more standard economic commentary, but again, what you're going to get here on the Bob Murphy Show is not just economics, it's all sorts of interesting things to promote free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. Catch you next time, everybody.
You've just experienced another episode of the Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.